WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In the introduction to her new book, Primitive Art in Civilized Places, anthropologist Sally Price describes her book as being about how, quote, objects from around the world have been discovered, seized, commoditized, stripped of their social ties, redefined in new settings, and reconceptualized to fit into the economic, cultural, political, and ideological needs of people from distant societies, end quote. Those distant societies she refers to are those inhabited by educated Westerners or people who fancy themselves as art connoisseurs. Throughout her work as an anthropologist, she's studied cultural life amongst Andalusian cork and olive growers, Caribbean fishermen, and Mayan corn farmers. I asked her why she turned her ethnographic skills in the more rarefied world of art dealers and collectors.
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that the whole notion of primitive art is a Western construct. That is, there is no such thing as primitive art. There's no unity in the arts of people in the Northwest Coast and Oceania and Africa and the Suriname rainforest. There's nothing that unifies those arts except in the Western perception of things.
You explain about the issue of anonymity, that for a lot of collectors, the fact that an art object is anonymous is part of the excitement, the seductiveness of it. And you quote a Parisian collector as saying, once you learn who made an object, it ceases to be primitive art. What's going on there? Why is the anonymity so important?
It's part of the more general dehumanization, I think, of the artist behind primitive art. When you look at museum collections that have labels underneath the objects, it's much more common to find the name of a collector under the object than the artist himself or herself. And that's not because we can't discover the names of these people. They are available if we went out and looked for them in many cases. But there's a kind of appropriation of primitive art that ends up making us the authors of the aesthetic that's being represented. Collectors often talk to me about how their collection, the aesthetic behind their collection, was their own. It was not something that the original artist intended. It was the artist was crafting an object, not designing an object, and working according to age-old traditions and so on. And it was the collector who really selected and therefore became the author of the aesthetic element in that collection.
It sounds like you're saying the collector then sees her or himself as the artist.
In a sense, that's true. If we think about cultural authority, and we're talking in many cases about people who consider themselves authorities on so-called primitive art, the word authority is very related to the word authorship, and there's a tendency for a sleight of hand there, a little slippage that allows people, in a sense, to see themselves as the creators of this art, not in the sense of making particular pieces, but in allowing their aesthetic vision to define the beauty of these things. And for that, of course, the original artist must be anonymous.
Your book includes some chronicles of collecting from the 1930s, which take Indiana Jones two or three egregious steps beyond. People actually going into to cultures and stealing items, slipping sacred flutes into their boots, objects, right, you know, into umbrellas, in order to sort of steal them away. Is this still going on? Do you still see this going on around the world?
Yes. The example that I quoted in extenso in the book was from the 1930s, simply because it was a case that was written up, I thought, extremely well by a French anthropologist named Michel Leiris, who described very openly and I think very well the kinds of tactics that he used traveling across Africa. But the practices that he described are certainly not over. They are less frequently talked about and less eloquently talked about now, but the kinds of things that he described happen all the time in all parts of the world now.
Have you seen any contemporary theft going on in the course of your field work?
Yes, I have.
How does that take place? What do you see?
And that's something that I think I'd rather not include in this interview, except to say that it is very pervasive.
How do objects get from the field into one of those apartment houses along Park Avenue that somehow look like bank safe deposit boxes?
You know, well, they rarely come directly from the field into a collection. What happens, as it was explained to me by dealers, principally in Paris, was that when an object comes in from the field, directly from, let's say, someplace in Africa, it has relatively little value, and it's traded around in a network. And as it passes from dealer to dealer or collector to collector, it acquires what I've described as the pedigree, and its value increases as it makes the rounds of different named collectors. And so that's an important process in establishing its value, and it finally comes to rest in some collection with a much higher value than when it came into the system, simply because of having passed through the hands of people who are known to have a discerning eye.
You reproduce a number of ads in the book, how we view primitive sort of base, untrammeled-like ideas of perhaps so-called primitive people with sexuality. There are also ads reproduced from the American Museum of Natural History, a poster of one of their exhibits of arts from the Suriname rainforest, and there's what looks like something that might be a quilt or a painting. And the copy above it says, "If we didn't tell you it came from the Suriname rainforest, you'd think it was modern art." What were you hoping to illustrate with that?
Well, this occurs in the chapter of the book that's devoted to my own experience in presenting the arts of the Suriname Maroons in the United States. And that ad is the second stage of an experience that began with the poster for the exhibit, which also featured that same textile. The exhibit was co-curated with my husband, Richard Price, who is also an anthropologist. We had chosen that textile as the object that we wanted featured on the poster. And the reaction by a public relations person who was dealing with the poster was, "This isn't primitive art. This looks like modern art. This is not what we want. Is a fetish, or we want a some kind of little statue, something that looks like primitive art." And our point in insisting on using that textile was that primitive art comes in many different shapes and sizes. People in other cultures make all kinds of things, and that's why we insisted on that textile. And what happened was that the textile was used for the poster. And by the time the exhibit arrived in New York, what happened was that perceived incongruity was picked up on by another public relations person who used it for its shock value. I mean, this doesn't look like primitive art. This is shocking to us. This is not our traditional notion of primitive art, and so it was used in that sense in a positive way for public relations. But in both cases, the idea was, this is not our notion of what primitive art should look like, but in fact, it is one of many examples of what primitive art does look like.
How do you view the art of the Maroons when you're in Suriname yourself? What has made the difference for you? What has made you sort of come to accept it as an art that has a context of a people? Has it been learning their language? Has that been what's the critical issue for you?
Well, certainly we did learn their language. We lived with the Maroons for about 3 years and came to understand that not only art, but also aesthetic thinking was very important to them. People talked about art a lot, and there was awareness, aesthetic awareness of what they were doing with their arts, and there was also a very clear art historical consciousness, and that's another area where people have very distinct ideas, very fixed ideas about Western art versus non-Western art, and the received wisdom is that people outside of our own traditions, or what Joseph Alsop called the great traditions, I think he has a list of five or six, that these people have no sense of art history, that that's very special to our more advanced civilizations. And in Suriname, we found that people were very aware of different periods, what we would call art historical periods, different styles. They were named styles for different generations going back, and we were able to delineate a very clear art history and pick up on a very strong art historical consciousness in this society.
Well, Sally Price, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
It's been my pleasure.
Anthropologist Sally Price is a visiting professor at Stanford University and the author of Primitive Art in Civilized Places. It's published by the University of Chicago Press.